a call from a foreign country that simply said, what are you doing the next couple of weeks? From one of our commended workers. What do you mean, what am I going to do the next couple of weeks? What's going on? A couple of days later, a telephone came, and the commended worker said, I'll be home in a couple of days. I want to spend some time with you. The commended worker came home and spent 3 weeks in my home. The only people from our assembly who knew that he was in America were the elders. And he poured out a tremendous story of continual discouragement, financial lows, work that started off well that now leveled off and didn't look like it was going to go anywhere. Having poured his life out in the lives of many people and not sensing any kind of reciprocal love and encouragement. And he poured out this story of trials and problems, and he poured out a story of an affair. And it's a mess. After a year, it's a mess. Just before I came, my old colleague from Colombia, who's now working in Los Angeles with the Latin American Assembly and seeking to found assemblies, I've been out there once and will be going again to help him soon, called me up to just confirm my travel arrangements and sent me a little note, and he's discouraged. And it's uncharacteristic of Dick to be discouraged that way. When we worked together, he was usually holding me up. And it seemed to be uncharacteristic of him. But he'd come back from New Zealand, and his vision is going. There's so much to do. There's so much rubble lying around. So many loose ends. And we were making some progress, and now we don't seem to be making any progress. And discouragement has come into his life in many ways, many doors, many angles. I think of that verse in Peter, the manifold grace of God. Trials come in from all kinds of things, big or small, the grain of sand in our shoe, or perhaps something bigger. And so does the grace of God. Wherever a trial comes in, the grace of God enters in and is able to meet the need. But discouragement is something that I would like to get into. I, unfortunately, have been susceptible to discouragement or spiritual depression. Although I have studied some counseling courses, and much to my surprise, I've never had what you would be called clinically depressed, which was a great surprise to me. But I have been discouraged. And as a young missionary going out to Colombia, South America, I visualized the day when I would be 50 or 52, and I'm 52. Those days when I would reach a certain level, I would have hundreds of sermons behind me, a lot of Bible knowledge, a tremendous amount of experience. I would have gone through all kinds of things, and I would reach a place in my ministry where I could push on the cruise control and just kind of move right through the ministry. And lo and behold, I'm 52 years old, and I'm still praying, and I'm still wondering what's going on, and I'm still wondering what in the world's happening, and I still prepare before I get up and speak, and I still occasionally have butterflies in my stomach. And I thought maybe when I was 52 years old, I wouldn't have that. Discouragement is something that comes into our lives in many ways and in many shapes, many forms. Years ago, I read missionary books, the biographies, just as everybody else did. Kind of interesting. When I was a young man, I read these, Hudson Taylor and William Carey and George Mueller, and I even in Bible school read Finney's lectures on revival, and even wrote a paper on it. I do not necessarily agree with his theological perspective or even his theory on revivals, but I read it and wrote a paper on it. But when I read all of these, I was looking for methods. I was looking for keys to success. So I devoured these books. And then for a long time, I put them aside. I'm not sure why, but I put these books aside. Later on, I came back to them again, and much to my surprise, as I began to read these books, I discovered something that I wasn't even looking for. I discovered successful Christian lives forged in the furnace of trials and testing. The first time I read these, I was looking for methods. God's work done in God's way, whenever last God supplied, that's true. But I was looking for the spiritual secrets of their success. Later on, I began to find out that there were many other factors in their lives that led these people to be used. And much of it was discouragement and trials and difficulties. I love the Apostle Paul. He's been an example of energy, an example of vision, insight, love, devotion. But I also love the fact that he left us one major book that tells us about some problems and trials he had that have become a textbook for my life recently. You know I'm talking about 2 Corinthians. Open to 2 Corinthians chapter 2, please. I am so thankful for the book of 2 Corinthians. So thankful for it. Because as I've been discouraged or spiritually depressed and I have sought answers and I've read and I've studied, I was brought to this man and I was brought to think about his life and to get into this book, and much to my amazement, he left us a tremendous resource on discouragement and its cures. In fact, I would suggest this. If you read 2 Corinthians, you might write down on a sheet of paper everything in that book that could discourage Paul. And there's a lot. And then you might write down another sheet of paper all of the ways that Paul handled that discouragement, and your heart will be lifted up. Let's read some verses here. I'm going to skip a couple of portions, and then I'm going to fill in. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. Furthermore, when I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel, and a door was opened to me by the Lord, I had no rest in my spirit, because I did not find Titus my brother. But taking my leave of them, I departed for Macedonia. Now, please go over to chapter 7, verses 5 and 6. And I'm sure you know where I was going. Chapter 7, verses 5 and 6. For indeed, when we came to Macedonia, our bodies had no rest. But we were troubled on every side. Outside were conflicts, inside were fears. You know how much I loved to read that years ago, inside were fears. I really enjoyed reading that. The Apostle Paul was a human being. Nevertheless, God, who comforts the downcast, comforted us by the coming of Titus. And not only by his coming, but also by the consolation with which he was comforting you when he told us your earnest desire, your mourning, your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced even more. Notice that word, downcast. And notice the word in chapter 2, no rest in my spirit. And then you'll notice as you get into chapter 4 of this book, as you would go back, you would use the word chapter 4, verse 1, lose heart. In chapter 4, verse 16, you would use the word lose heart. Or faint now, or faint. And then you will find this in a few other books. And Paul gives us a lot of insight. One of the problems, and I would like to be fairly specific this morning, one of the problems with our kind of work, the nature of our work, is that we can always point to a finished product. When I worked at Ellis Chalmers Corporation years ago in Milwaukee Electric Tool, at the end of the week I could say, look what I made. I worked on a grinding machine and certain machines, and I could say, look what I made. Or if I were a carpenter and I spent some time in my carpenter shop, I could come out and I could show you the cabinet. All of the angles are right. Everything is fits together beautifully. It's been stained, sanded, stained, varnished. And I can say, look what I made. You know what my workshop feels like sometimes? Wood chips and sawdust. And I often walk into this workshop and say, God made me something. And it's just a bunch of wood chips and sawdust. And he's making something. I know he is. But that's part of the nature of our work. We are involved in such a way that we cannot always show the finished product. Our workshops often look like wood shavings, wood chips, sawdust, angles not cut quite right, things that do not just seem to fit. And in the midst of all of this, we believe that God is doing something. He's making something. And that's why we walk by faith, not by sight. Paul gives some insight. Now, I'd like to give you some of my thoughts about the things that were troubling Paul. And I'm sure you're aware of these. When I minister or talk to young people in our area who are interested in the Lord's work, missionary work or whatever, I tell them, become students of 2 Corinthians. You must be in that book and you must master it. You must understand that book. Because they're going out with great enthusiasm. But you must understand what can take place. So I lead them to study this book. You can obviously see that this book has become a tremendous resource of encouragement for me. Paul wrote a first letter. There are some who think he wrote another letter called a severe letter, dealing with the problems in Corinth. I'm not sure, but he did write a letter. Some people had come to him from Corinth, and they brought some questions, they brought some verbal news, and they brought some things that were written down, and Paul addressed them in the first letter. And he addresses the problems, and apparently the letter went back, and it was not well received. Some people received it, some people received it well, but there were a group of people in Corinth who did not necessarily receive all that Paul had said. There are some thought that Paul even took a special trip directly from Ephesus to Corinth to deal with the problem that he was run out, or that he came back discouraged. I don't know. I understand that these are interesting ideas, but I don't know. But I do know this, that there were a group of people in Corinth who were upset with Paul. Be a minority or not, I don't know. And Paul felt at this time that he could not go back. Now, you remember he wrote to them, and he gave them a couple itineraries. I would like to come to see you, and I may go this way and come around, or I may go this way and come around, but I want to see you. And he didn't come. Now, when he didn't show up, his enemies said, he doesn't keep his word. You can't trust Paul. He doesn't keep his word. And so they accused him of being a man who spoke out of both sides of his mouth, didn't speak the truth. They also accused him of being a man who wanted to be a dictator. He just wants to rule your faith. All he wants to do is have the power. They accused him of vacillation. They accused him of not being a very good speaker. You and I know he was a good speaker. He just didn't speak in his style at the time, however that meant. See? But he was obviously a good speaker. But he didn't have the whatever it is you needed in those days to be a good speaker. I merely think of Abraham Lincoln and Senator Douglas, and one thinks of Douglas there for 3 hours arguing his case with all of the proper oratorial movements, and then I think of Lincoln in his simplicity. But they accused him of a lot of things. They said his message couldn't be very important, because if it was important, he'd take some money for it. This guy's doing building tents. See? If his message was worth anything, he would get some money out of it. And they accused him of many things. And meanwhile, Paul had opened his heart to these people. And he opened his heart to them, and he says, I love you, and the constraint is on your part. But Paul struggled with this. So he sent Titus. Titus was a good troubleshooter. Titus is in Crete. Titus is also sent to Corinth. And he says, Titus, you go there, and you bring me back some good news. And you take the land route. I'll meet you on I-43 and 94. And somewhere we'll meet over there. Paul went out to Troas, and a door, he says, was open to me. A wonderful opportunity. And he got to Troas, and he was restless. What's Titus? I wonder what's going on. Why should I start anything new when the other thing is falling apart? Why should I give my heart here when all of that time I give the coin could be ruined? I remember very well the first assembly I was involved in starting in Ciudad Jardin in Bogota. I remember very well, after about 4 years and I had gone to Bucaramanga, the assembly was falling apart. It's too long to go into. It was bad. It was bad. And that was my first work. That's what it was, my work. That was bad. And I was driving from Bucaramanga to Bogota to help these people. And meanwhile, in Bucaramanga, exciting things were happening. And I can remember coming back from Bogota once feeling just lost. Lost. I spent all of that time in Bogota, and we're trying to start something in Bucaramanga. What's the matter? A loss of confidence sometimes makes us discouraged. A loss of confidence. Lord, what mistakes have I made? Didn't we pray? Didn't we teach? And my mind was full of these things. And when I got back to Bucaramanga, there was no joy in the work in Bucaramanga. My heart and my emotions were with the people in Bogota. And I can remember, and I think of Paul as he goes into Troas. preaches the gospel, wonderful doors open. And then his mind and his heart and his emotions are there in Corinth, and he's anxious for the coming of Titus. And he says, those that are downcast, God comforts those that are downcast, depressed, discouraged, downcast. And Paul uses the word, and I believe he's referring to himself. A loss of confidence sometimes makes us discouraged. What's going on, and have I done this right, and maybe the Lord's not blessing me, and you know, you can have a lot of things. Maybe I've done something wrong, maybe I'm too hard, maybe I don't understand it. Lord, and this morbid introspection that often gets to us. So Paul was concerned about what was going on. So that's the story. Titus has gone off to Corinth. Paul enters Troas. He's anxious, no rest in his spirit, no peace of mind. He decides that he's going to go up the interstate to meet Titus somewhere because he wants news. He needs to hear it. He's downcast. All of the accusations against Paul were getting to him. And the fact that he opened his heart to these people and they weren't responding, that gets to you. How many of us have poured our lives out to someone? And initially they have responded, and then later on they've grown cold or critical or hard or walked away. I've experienced that, and I know what it's done for my heart. Discouragement, because I'm susceptible to this horrible disease of discouragement. So this is the case. Paul is there, and he is waiting, anxiously waiting for Titus, and he is discouraged. And Paul had not gone back to Corinth, by the way, because I feel, he said, I don't want to dominate your faith. I don't want to be a dictator. Paul just didn't want that kind of a run-in. Titus was the man for it. There were not only those difficulties, but there were other difficulties. There was the weakness of his body. Who is sufficient for these things? And there was the fact that all of life is a slippery slope sliding down a hill to weakness. He brings that out in the book. The weakness of body, and then the opposition of the enemy. We preach the word of God, and people do not always respond to it. And Paul talks about that in chapter 2, and we'll talk about that at the end, because those verses have sustained me. An active enemy. Whenever the gospel is spoken, there's an active enemy. Paul talks about the weapons he had to use, the weapons that were not carnal. And he is talking about many things that would discourage him. He could have lost his vision. He could have said things will never clear up. The loss of vision is a terrible thing, but it happens when there's too many loose ends and it's confusing. I think of my old colleague right now in Los Angeles, and I'm not saying he's in bad shape, but it's uncharacteristic of him to feel the way he does. And just by coincidence, I'll be out there in 2 weeks to do some speaking in Spanish assemblies with him and putting on a little leadership seminars with the elders and other things. So it just seems to work out right. Paul waited patiently then for Titus to come. And when Titus came, Paul says in chapter 7, of course, that he was encouraged. God who comforts the downcast comforted us by the coming of Titus. And not only by the coming of Titus, but by the good news that Titus brought. The kind of good news that helped Paul and encouraged him and realized that God was doing something, because Paul's vision was tarnished. But now he sees that the Holy Spirit is working, and Paul is encouraged by it, tremendously encouraged by it. A loss of confidence brings doubt, and sometimes a loss of vision causes discouragement when it seems so difficult for us to move on. I'd like to address something, though, this morning. I read a lot of material, just as you do. And some of the material I've read have fed me and encouraged me. One of my favorite authors is a man by the name of Eugene Peterson. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Presbyterian man who's been in the ministry. His recent book, Under the Unpredictable Plant, is a tremendous book on encouragement, analyzing the times we live in. And I've read a lot of these books. And today, there are other things that discourage. One of them, the things that discourage today, is the pressure and I must be careful because I want to bear fruit. But the pressure for success, the pressure for growth, the commercialization, the need for us to be fulfilled. A man by the name of Henry Nouwen says that the sin of our time in the ministry is not immorality. It's anger. Have you noticed how angry everybody is? How upset? Anger. Anger that things aren't going right. Anger that we're doing the right things and we're not producing the right things. May I make a statement? This is from Eugene Peterson's book, and it is not meant to shock. But he talks about in one chapter about the salesmanship and the glitz and glitter and all of the things that are promised to us in the ministry. And he calls it, and this is his term, ecclesiastical pornography. A beautiful picture, airbrushed and beautifully laid out, that discourages people because few of us ever reach that goal. Now, that's a hard term, but that's what he calls it. Doctored up and patched up. Today, we believe if we do the right things, we'll get the right results. If we gather our facts, if we promote optimism, if we choose the target community, choose our strategy. And by the way, I'm not trying to make statements about certain things. I'm just telling you because I'm going to go back and tell you a story about my own life. That goes way back before much of this even exploded on the scene. But this is the problem. I know a lot of young workers. A lot of them. Many of them think I'm a bit of an oddball. I meet them at camp and other places. They think I'm a bit of an oddball, and yet they talk to me. I think because perhaps they are able to get something from me. Many of them are discouraged. Many of them are mad. Mad because they've been working for this and it hasn't been achieved. Mad because these people over there haven't prayed hard enough, and so it's not getting done. Mad because this committee hasn't worked hard enough, and this committee has disappointed them. Mad because while they're on their way to doing the job, this oddball is coming to the assembly and he needs their attention, and they don't want to give the attention to see Christ formed in them because they have too much to do. And they're mad. They're angry. And I believe it's the sin of our time. And they find that what is happening is they begin to manipulate people. Manipulate them. People just become a commodity. I use them to achieve my goal. A worker said to me last summer, "Do you have anybody in your assembly, in your area, who don't like you?" I said, "Oh, sure. I think there are some people who like to bury me in an ant hill and let the ants crawl all over me. I don't know." "Sure." And he said, "Well, I've got some people where I work that are like that also." And he said, "I think we have to get rid of them, so we can get on with our work." Let me tell you something, people. There's only two reasons that I see we're supposed to ask people to leave the local assembly. Immorality, unrepented of. And doctrinal heresy, unrepented of. But just because somebody doesn't like me and walk with me, I don't ask them to get out of the way so I can get my goal done. This man was mad. Mad. We must get rid of him. That's a quote. And so we fall into, I think, a trap. We want to bear fruit. Now, I'm going to be getting Paul's answer, but we want to bear fruit. And we use the church like a hamburger joint. We live and die by visibility. And we have all of the ideas. We even use godliness as a gimmick. The godliness we use as a gimmick is that if I'm holy enough and godly enough, people will be attracted to the Lord. So godliness even becomes a gimmick. A gimmick for winning people. It is not holiness under the Lord. It's a gimmick so that people see the light reflected in me. When they see the light reflected in me, they perhaps will come to know the Lord. There are many things that have taken place. Paul was discouraged because of misunderstandings, false accusations, love that he gave to the people that was rejected, because he had been straightforward and given some answers, and those answers were not accepted as being true. And Paul was discouraged. And in this book, starting in chapter 2, and I'm sure you understand this, starting in chapter 2 at verse 15, all the way through chapter 7, verse 4, you will find what is called the Great Digression. In those chapters, Paul begins to unfold the answers to the problem of discouragement. Sometimes the book looks confusing. We read about no peace of mind when he was going to cross, and then later on, a few chapters later, he picks the phrase up, and in between he gives what appears to be often rambling thoughts. They are not rambling thoughts. They build a lot of ideas. Back in 1973, when I was in Bucaramanga, I went to the Imagine office one day, and I opened the courses, and I began to answer the questions. I answered the questions in the back of the Emmaus courses. I walked in the office one day and opened the pack, and there was my first question, and it said, "Señor Director, did Adam have a belly button?" And I exploded. I exploded. I shoved it aside, I threw my glasses on the table, and I exploded. And I went down for a tinto. Now, if you've been to Columbia, you know what I mean. I went down for a tinto or two to a coffee shop, and I began to realize, people, that it was mad. I had exploded. When I walked out of the Emmaus office, Sophia said, "Ask where I was going when I would be back." And in my most gentle, kind, tender Christian way, I said, "It's none of your business when I come back. I can do what I want." Very tender, very gentle. And I went down to have a tinto, and I found a table underneath the stairway with a few cobwebs, and I sat, had to be in the dark because I was feeling so rotten, and I sat back there drinking my tinto, sulking. And then the Lord brought some verses to me from this book and began slowly to unlock my heart and bring light to me. Questions came to me when I was sitting there, and this is how wonderful God's grace is. "Did I call you, John?" "And you did." "You really believe that I'm in your life?" "Yeah, yeah." "My conversion, everything?" "Yes, Lord, you're there." "Okay. But I need you here." "Well, we waited 6 months in Bogota praying about where we would go, meticulously praying, ended up in Bucaramanga." "Yeah, Lord, you left here." "Okay. Did I call you to climb the evangelical ladder of success?" "I don't think so." Now, one of the reasons I exploded was this. In the early 70s, church growth movement hit Columbia like a bomb. Everybody was running around with their programs, and they would say, "A year here, it doesn't work," and they'd be a year here, and there are people in this room who could testify, and somebody would run over there for 2 years, and it didn't work, and they run over there, and they were wondering, where's the action? And they were running around causing dust, and the dust was flying all over the place. And I was reading about the glitch and the glitter in the programs, and I'm sitting in Bucaramanga, slowly getting angry. Oswald Chambers, in 1917, wrote about success, and he said, "When success is our goal," and I love his little phrase, "it creates a subtle irritability." Well, mine wasn't subtle. A subtle irritability, Oswald Chambers calls it. I had exploded. And then and there, very slowly, God began to unravel in my life the things that caused me discouragement and the wrong perspective I had on issues. And see, I'm a slow learner. It took a little while for it to come through. I began to think it through. I was jealous. I didn't want to serve in obscurity. I'll tell you right off, I didn't want to serve in obscurity. I was reading all the reports, I was jealous. And slowly but surely, I become angry at the Lord. I left the coffee shop feeling as if the Lord began his renewal, and the renewal began there. I went back, apologized to Sophia, and she just had a funny smile on her face. And I went back and I tried to answer the question about, did Adam have a belly button? And the Lord began to unfold to me this wonderful encouragement. The sin of the Spirit, this sin of the Spirit that we have, is not easily discerned. For example, is it the work of the Holy Spirit or boastful arrogance that I want to do something? Hard to discern. I want to be used. When I go to be with the Lord, I want to be used, and I want to stand before Him, and I want to bear fruit. But what I began to see that had happened to me is that I was listening to many things, and I was becoming jealous, and I was becoming sure that God didn't know what He was doing, and that I wanted more and needed more. Much of self was in it. Now let's turn back to this book, please. Paul is discouraged. And in these chapters I mentioned that start in chapter 2 at verse 14 and go to chapter 7, Paul gives a lot of insight. For me, I had to arrive at a position where I was willing to be a drink offering poured out upon the service and the sacrifice of other people. And I had to believe that God would take the sawdust and wood chips and do something with it. When I was a young man in the ministry and or in school studying, we would have people come to the chapel, speak. By the way, they should give us more grace. Hubert Mitchell, a man who wrote the music for that, used to come to our chapel at school and play the piano. Helen Barth would come and sing, but and we would hear speakers, and sometimes the speaker would be introduced, and the director of the chapel would say, "Here is Brother Joel Smith, and he has been serving the Lord for 7 years in outer Afghanistan or something, and it took 5 years before he had his first convert." My generation, we said, "What wonderful consecration. Wow. What dedication. To be able to work all that time but in a culture and a language. What consecration." A couple of summers ago, there were another young couple, full-time workers, commended workers, some old friends, and they were very discouraged about their work, and they talked to me at camp. And they were angry about a lot of things that weren't happening. People didn't like them or appreciate them, or their plans weren't being reached, or they couldn't get people to catch their vision, and they were frustrated, and they had tried all kinds of ways to get these people to catch their vision. And the woman, when we were talking, we were at park bench at camp, the woman said, "I know what the problem is." I said, "May I use an example?" "Probably a very poor example," I said, "but I'd like to share it with you anyway. The example is what it, just what I told you about Bible school." I said, "Would you have had a person like that in your chapel when you went?" And she said, "No. We would not have had a person like that." Now, she said, "When I went to school, we didn't have those kind of people speak in our chapel. Who'd you have speak in your chapel?" "Well, we had this person and that person." Godly people. Successful people. But they never heard of Plugger. They never heard of Plugger. And they caught this vision, they caught this idea that things have to go fast and be productive, and that God's going to use our lives, and our goal is to manipulate and get people to catch our vision. And if people won't catch our vision, we would like to see them leave. See, she heard no Pluggers, and her husband agreed. "We never heard any Pluggers." "Sure you would. In my day," I said, "we may need a gentle nudge or a shove or maybe a swift kick to get us moving. But in my day, dedication and consecration was the key word, not success and assertiveness." Read Eugene Peterson. Search out his book, Working the Angle, the Shape of Pastoral Integrity. Notice the word pastoral saw you on. The Shape of Pastoral Integrity. Read Under the Unpredictable Plant, A Call to Vocational Holiness. Read Praying the Psalms, and God answers in the Psalms. Such insight that you'll be greatly encouraged. So as I talked to this couple, we went over some of these matters and began to realize that our perspective is different. What's the antidote for some of Paul's discouragement? Remember, he loved them. He had trials. They didn't think he was a very honest man. They doubted some of his motives. What is the antidote for this? The first one is to love the Lord, not people. Now, don't misunderstand me. When a young missionary says, I'm going out to Colombia because I love the Colombians, I like to pull them aside and gently say, no, you love the Lord. Because when you're in the barrios preaching, the people you love will let the air out of all four of your tires, or slash a couple, or rip your tape deck out, and make life miserable for you. You go because you love the Lord. And you love Him. You will learn to love the Colombians, and I'm sorry to say, not all of them. You will learn to love them. Paul's service was not just love for others, but love for his Lord. His devotion was not just to gain the love and approval of other people, but the love and approval of the Lord. That's what his devotion. And if we live just for the approval of other people, we will quickly be brokenhearted and defeated, and we will be discouraged. And you and I know Paul had a capacity to love people. He said, because I've loved you, and even though you don't love me best, he says later on, I love you, and I've opened my heart to you. So he had a great capacity to love people. But part of the antidote is to love the Lord. Lord, I love you, and I want to serve you, and I want to be what you want me to be. The other encouragement Paul had, and I'm going to this rather rapidly now, is his exalted view of the gospel. The exalted view of the gospel. He had in chapter 3, and I'll just go through this quickly, he describes the radiant glory of the covenant of grace, contrasted with the covenant of law. And what a radiant gospel it is. It shines bright, and each generation it continues to shine brighter and brighter. It doesn't dim. It doesn't get dull. And when it moves into people's lives, it makes them living letters, and it changes them, and it shines. In fact, at the end of chapter 3, he said, and we show and reflect this glory in a continuing way. And then he says right away in chapter 4, because of this ministry, we do not lose heart. It is a ministry of a message that needs to be proclaimed clearly and decisively from a clear conscience with no tricks, no craftiness. The message itself will create life. And Paul knew that not everybody would be saved. He says in chapter 4, when the gospel is preached, there's an enemy who wants to blind the minds of people and veil them. He understood that our battle is more than methodology. See, in 1973, I learned that slowly. I still want to do things, and I read all of the time, and I've taken some seminars, and I'm learning. But the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. In his book, he says, who is sufficient for these things? I don't have the self-confidence for it, he said. The self-confidence that we feel we have to have. So Paul talks about the wonderful message, and as he talks about it, he says that we do not lose heart because we have a ministry, a message that creates life. And when we lose the sense of wonder at the message that has been entrusted to us, we lose heart. That happens. The discouragement, trying to all kinds of ways to get people to accept. One day I was sitting in my office in Bucaramanga, and the Colombian leader of Alpha E Omega came in to see me. We were near the university campus, and he offered to use the man's courses. And he said, Juan, I want to ask you a question. And I thought, he's going to ask me if Adam has a belly button, I'm ready. That's not what he asked me. But I was ready for this one. So. By the way, if you want to know, I'll tell you later. You can talk. Anyway. So what can I do for you? I can't remember his name anymore. He said, I want to ask you a question. Out of every 10 people that your work here leads to Jesus Christ, how many do you have a year later? I was kind of embarrassed because we haven't kept statistics, and I just didn't. I ran through names through my mind, and very embarrassingly I said, 7 out of 10. And I said, that's not a very good batting average. He looked at me and his mouth dropped open and he said, we only have 1 out of 10 at the end of the year. What are we doing wrong? I don't have the slightest idea, I said. I'll say, but I asked him some questions. Pretend I'm a university student. Share the message that you share with them with me. And he began to share the message, and then I caught on. Then I caught on. Your message isn't very complete, I said. And he was joking. Your message isn't very complete. Well, what do you mean? I said, you've talked about God's love, and you've talked about his forgiveness, but there's something about it that gives me a restlessness. He didn't hit sin very hard. And then he said, well, you know, that's interesting, because when the people make a decision and come in, and months later we start talking with them about putting away their girlfriend or doing this or doing that, then they walk out. They say, that's none of your business. I said, I think your message is effective. Your message of the love of God is correct as far as it goes. But the minute you get into their lives and you start getting down to business, they rebel, they chase, they walk out. Maybe I said they weren't looking for a savior from sin. Maybe they were looking for a savior that would lead them to success. I don't have the slightest idea. So we spent quite a bit of time in the mayor's office talking about this. And you see, Paul, because of the glory of his ministry, he says in chapter 4, the wonderful glory of it, we've renounced the hidden things of shame, not walking in craftiness, nor handling the word of God deceitfully, but by manifestation of the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And I love that verse. Speaking it so that somebody else's conscience can respond favorably or unfavorably. Or they can respond that what I'm saying is the truth, but speaking it so that their conscience can be moved. So he has a glorious, life-changing message. And then he moves on in chapter 4, and he tells us that in spite of that life-changing message, and in spite of not being discouraged, there are trials that come into life. Chapter 4, 7, we have this treasure in earthen vessels. And he begins to tell us about all of his trials, being confused, but not to the point of not knowing what to do, being weak, but not knocked out, being perplexed at times, not knowing, but knowing that God has control of things. And he tells us this, and remember this, that it's important for us to understand that in weakness is strength. And I hit weakness, and I've worked hard not to be weak, and then the Lord puts me in a place where I'm weak and I'm a fool. And he says, you've got it wrong, Ducky, you've got it wrong. That's what he said in 73, and it started sword. You got it wrong, Ducky. You're trying to be slick and polished and get it all together so that whenever you touch something, it will come out that beautiful cabinet. And I'm going to snafu you along the way, if I can use that word, to show you that in weakness is strength. And people, I hate weakness. I hate being a fool. And yet that's what he does. So these trials, and all the way through this book, read these portions, how wonderful it is. And then he talks about the body, and we don't lose heart. Verse 16 of chapter 4. Even though the outward man is perishing, the inward man is renewed day by day. And we worry about these bodies, and we're sure them, we care for them, but these bodies are slipping away. And they're going, and they're slipping. And that's not what the life is anyway. It will be gone once. And he talks about this treasure, and he won't lose heart, even though he can't see everything, and the body is slipping away. And we walk by faith, not by sight. We look on the things that are not seen. Think of how absurd that is. How can you look on something that's not seen? Moses endured seeing him who was invisible. How can you see somebody who's invisible? And yet, that's exactly how it is. Our eyes and our hearts are on something else. And we're looking to him, and we endure seeing him who's invisible. To me, walking by faith, not by sight, to me, walking without looking at the things that are seen means this. Every day when I read, I realize it's valuable for something even though I don't see it. When I pray, when I share, when I work, whatever I do, I believe that God's in it. That's walking by faith, not by sight. And when I come across a person and they leave or they move away or have been involved with him and they don't have any idea what God is doing. I believe that God knows what he's doing and he's taking care of it.